Dr. Emery. He's at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University, and he will be speaking on promotion bias in medical product research.
Thank you, Amy. This talk is going to be a little bit different. It's more or less a consciousness-raising effort. It's possible that consciousness needs to be raised less in this meeting than in others. You all saw the slide that flashed past here that has preceded every presentation at this meeting. And actually, that went away. But this talk is really about that slide and the environment that has motivated this obsessive-compulsive kind of coverage of conflict of interest at this meeting and many medical meetings, but not at the statistical meetings at which we're involved. So I have no relationships to disclose, but of course we all have conflicts of interest, and I do, but they're not financial, and I don't believe they're pertinent to this talk. We'll come back to that. So I'm going to talk about what I mean by promotion bias, what it is. Oh my God, excuse me. And I left my handouts, which were a major issue in this talk, in my room. And I apologize. So I have a large reference list. I can't believe I did that. But I have a large reference list, which anybody's interested should email me for, and I'll email it to you. The reference list is to acquaint you with what's going on, what's been going on in the medical research literature for some time now, and what is, in essence, threatening the medical profession's credibility in research and our credibility in research in which we work with the medical profession. So I'm going to talk in a highly condensed way about the ramifications of this issue for the biostatistical community. I want to put a caution in front. I'm not out here to shoot people. I'm not a Manichaean. I don't believe this is a black and white problem. I don't believe that we are surrounded by commercial evildoers and that academics are black and white, are white knights and so on and so forth. I don't believe any of that. I do think we have a substantial problem with a few villains, not many, and I'm not on a search and destroy mission, but I think the biostatistical community has to be sensitized to these issues in ways that we are not sensitized now. That's the purpose of this talk. So by promotion bias, I mean the distortion of the production and communication of scientific information and or the misrepresentation of its source by the commingling of marketing with clinical investigation. I don't see marketing in the benign light that Paula's talk just placed it, but I don't see it as an evil enterprise either. Marketing is simply marketing, but it has different goals and objectives than scientific investigation. This commingling generates directional pressures on scientific reporting when these things get mixed up and perceptions of conflict of interest, whether or not there are real conflicts of interest that are occurring. And my claim is that the risk of promotion bias, this kind of bias, is high in complex systems with diffused responsibility, which is where the clinical research enterprise is now. Is heading and continues to head in more and more complex circumstances. So just to belabor the point, in clinical scientific research, at least for the most part, I think you would agree with me that the product benefit is desired but not assumed, the predisposition is to neutrality or skepticism, the reward is for confirmation and acceptance of innovation, and one's primary responsibility is to patients in the scientific community. But in the marketing and medical communications, the product benefit is by necessity presumed, predisposition is to advocacy of the benefit of the product. The reward is for dissemination and acceptance of advocacy, and the primary responsibility is to the client business arm. And these last two introduce possibilities for conflict of interest, recognizing that all of us in all professions have ethical imperatives to which we respond that transcend these immediate issues, but nevertheless, they differ. So these are both worthy enterprises, but they can be a toxic mix, or at least that is my claim. So what is the nature of conflict of interest? It's a multidimensional problem, including financial issues and other issues, including the need to have prestige and to feel useful, the need to protect one's job or to please one's superior, the need to support a scientific group, a grant application, or a student, or the perception of such a need, and the desire to help friends and colleagues succeed. These are much less quantifiable, but at least as real as financial conflicts of interest. The American Association of Medical Colleges defines conflict of interest in a way that equates actual conflict of interest with appearance of conflict. So there's no gray area. Basically, if it looks like there might be a conflict, there is a conflict. And recognizes that conflict of interest can be inherent in an environment and the potential for it is present in all work environments. And I would strongly emphasize that. Potential for it is present everywhere. But secure scrutiny and enforcement on conflict of interest inevitably tends to focus on the measurable and high-stakes financial situations, and as opposed to scrutinizing people's friendships. So this is the most recent issue in the news. This is from a letter of Charles Grassley to the head of Emory, president of Emory University, about Professor Charles Nemiroff, who's an active researcher in psychopharmacology. And the accusation that Dr. Grassley has leveled at Dr. Nemiroff and at Emory University is that Dr. Nemiroff has failed to disclose approximately $500,000 and a minimum of support for his investigations and his efforts, which have had influence on the community, medical community, in terms of treatment. And this is a case in point, and that in fact that Dr. Nemiroff was not truthful with his employers, Emory University, and that Emory University, in essence, waved this under the carpet and ignored it for many, many years. And in fact, there's a history of this investigator having problems that led him to step down from the editorship of a major journal in the neurosciences prior to this, so this wouldn't be the first time this has come up. So Dr. Nemiroff, as a consequence, this month voluntarily stepped down as the head of his department. Emory is investigating him. He basically defends himself and says, I've followed appropriate university regulations concerning financial disclosures, but Grassley's letter directly contradicts that. NIH has frozen over $9 million in funding for his grants. He stepped down as PI, and Emory had, the whole university has been put under special restrictions by NIH on its NIH proposals and receipt of NIH funding. This is both but the most recent event in a series of events that are, and these are quotes from several medical journal editors in the bottom from an article by Doug Altman and colleagues. I'll just read them real quick. Medical journal editors found themselves playing a game of research hide-and-seek from the editor of NEJM. In one sense, all journals are bought or at least cleverly used by the pharmaceutical industry, the editor of British Medical Journal. We were burned very badly, the editor of JAMA. And the reporting of trial outcomes is not only frequently incomplete, but also biased and inconsistent with protocols. That's from Altman and colleagues. And that is, in fact, the basis of the prior three comments. These are some of the areas, time doesn't permit my going into these in any sense, but these are some of the areas in which there have been major concerns, both in safety and efficacy with COX-2 inhibitors, cyclooxygenase inhibitors, in terms of efficacy, thyroid drugs, a trial of an HIV agent, a purported HIV agent, safety and efficacy of antidepressants of various sorts, issues with the safety of implantable cardioverter defibrillators, and with aproton, which is a perioperative anti-clotting agent. These are areas of high profile where there were major issues and concerns about scientific integrity and the reporting process in one way or another. I'm going to show you some examples. These are recent examples. One can go back, and again, the handout that I left. The handout basically contains a collection of about 6 or 8 pages of literature that I urge you to look at. This is from January 2008 in NAJM. Basically, these investigators compared filings on the FDA website with the FDA of clinical investigations on certain antidepressants with publications in the literature and to see if they were consistent with one another. And one of their conclusions was that lots of studies were negative according to the filing with the FDA or interpreted by the FDA as negative, but published either as positive studies or published as positive studies with different outcomes. And research of this sort, this kind of muckraking research, and I'll show you a number of these papers, these research papers are themselves subject to considerable scrutiny and aren't always of the highest methodological rigor, and lots of them are take cheap shots. But my reading of these, and I think your reading, if you follow the track that I've gone through in reading this literature, is that at the core of most of these research papers, there are issues of very severe concern, even if not everything that they say is valid. So these researchers say that for FDA negative or questionable publication positive studies, places where somebody published a positive result, but the FDA thought they were negative, or the result filed with the FDA was negative. Although for each, the finding with respect to the primary outcome is non-significant, each publication highlighted a positive result as if it were the primary outcome. The non-significant results for the pre-specified primary outcomes were either subordinated to non-primary positive outcomes in 2 reports or omitted in 9. So you make a contract, in essence, with the FDA to do a protocol-based investigation and look at a certain primary endpoint, but you never publish that one. You find one that looks better, and you publish that one, and the other one is sort of squirreled away in the FDA website. April of 2008, An investigation of documents filed in the investigations of Vioxx in court. Per protocol and on treatment, follow-up analyses of safety with less unfavorable safety results than a major initial safety analysis that was done combining two clinical trials were published, and the initial ITT, intention to treat, pooled total mortality analysis, two large trials, was never published, but was filed. It actually was not filed with the FDA. The unpublished analysis not provided to the FDA suggested a tripling of mortality risk with Vioxx, with statistically significant elevation in both trials, but the other kinds of non-ITT analyses or ITT or analyses that did not cover the full period of follow-up of these patients were published, and this one was not. Each of those looked somewhat better. What all this amounts to is the perception by the medical community that physicians are deprived by industry of data, especially safety data, needed for patient care. The stakes can be very high. It can be billions of dollars in the case of thyroid and the sale of a company and the price at which that occurred, and it can be thousands of lives, estimated as 30 to 40,000 lives by an associate director of the FDA in connection with the use of Vioxx. There are practices involved here that contribute to difficulties that also cause this lack of trust. And science's marketing is a major issue. Seeding trials address medically minor or marketing-specific questions and pay hundreds or thousands of physicians to each enroll a few patients in trials or a product. Empirically, these have been shown to influence prescribing patterns in the practices that participate with a few patients in the clinical trials. Basically, you introduce the drug. It's a way to get them to practice on a few research patients, and then they tend to use the drug more. The priorities of these trials are product dissemination is high priority. Results dissemination is low priority. Thank you. Guest and ghost authorships involve late involvement of academic opinion leaders as primary guest authors for studies conceived, executed, and interpreted by a sponsor or contractors to the sponsor. The financial links of the guest author to the sponsor are not always declared, and the papers are largely written by sponsor staff and or retained medical writing, communications, or PR firms. These are the ghost authors. Responsibility for analyses in guest-authored manuscripts is implicitly attributed to guest authors and their academic institutions, but it's actually attributable to ghost authors employed by the sponsor or medical writing marketing firm. And here is a quote from, this is an acknowledged seeding ghost guest-authored study, and this is the first author and what he said. The sponsor designed the trial, paid for the trial, ran the trial, came to me after the study was completed and said, we want your help to work on the paper. The initial paper was written at the sponsor, and then it was sent to me for editing. Basically, I went with the cardiovascular data that was presented to me, and this is a trial that's controversial because there were cardiovascular deaths associated with the drug that were not included in the research paper. Here is a study of guest authorship and ghost authorship, ghost writing and publications related to Vioxx, again based on the litigation filings. And the conclusions are, and again, this is not on, these studies can be attacked as well, but my feeling is that there is a core of a real problem in them. The case study review of industry documents demonstrates that clinical trial manuscripts related to Vioxx were authored by sponsor employees, but often attributed first authorship to academically affiliated investigators who did not always disclose industry financial support. Review manuscripts were often prepared by unacknowledged authors and subsequently attributed authorship to academically affiliated investigators who often did not disclose industry financial support. Another study, again by the Altman Group, we found evidence of ghost authorship for 75% of trials. The prevalence of ghost authorship was increased to 91% when we included cases where a person qualifying for authorship was acknowledged rather than appearing as an author. And in 31 trials, the ghost authors we identified were statisticians. It is likely that we have overlooked some ghost authors. And so we are, for better or for worse, and whether this is worthy of praise or blame or whatever, we are inextricably enmeshed in this problem. With all the best of intentions, even if we are behaving totally ethically, we are wrapped up in this problem. We can't quite get away from it. So consider science as marketing. Consider a research program conceived to both produce informative data and meet marketing objectives, like develop prevalence and progression data on a common condition, demonstrate the unmet need for utilization of a company product, and funded by a corporate marketing unit where academic physician scientists ask questions and function like a board of directors. This is just fine as far as I'm concerned. This is just great. But suppose there's an undistributed contract PR medical writing firm that coordinates the meetings, does some analyses, and prepares the papers. Suppose the company provides the funds, collects the data, conducts some analyses. And suppose that polished drafts of papers are furnished to the academic physician scientists who become the primary authors. In a situation like this, the papers may go to JAMA, NEJM, BMG, and so on, the journals where the editors were quoted in an earlier slide. The quality of the science from this kind of production process may be very high indeed, but it will depend on the timing and distribution of responsibilities and authority between the medical scientists and academia and industry, the corporate PR marketing people, the corporate marketing responsors. And where does the buck stop? Who ensures the scientific integrity of the results? Is scientific attribution in these papers valid? Sometimes, what if some data like drug-associated deaths are omitted from the papers? Who is to blame? Who did it? Who deserves praise when something comes out? And how does one argue the scientific issues? How is biostatistics involved? I have about 1 minute to get this out. And I apologize for the rush, but does any profession depend more on unfiltered, unbiased information flow than applied statistics? To what discipline is understanding and controlling sources of bias and data intellectually most central? Selective reporting threatens us, and when things go wrong, we may not be to blame, but we are involved. Our response to this situation has largely been to circle the wagons and defend ourselves against tendencies in medical journals, JAMA in particular, to implement external scrutiny by academics of industry-sponsored trials and data analysis in such trials in a way that is discriminatory against our industry members, industry colleagues, which is wrong. But we need as a profession to respond in another way. We need to basically ally with the medical reformers who are mistakenly doing that, but I think are right on target in some of the other reforms they're trying to implement to promote openness and transparency in the clinical research process with regard to conflict of interest and everything else. And the statistical profession is not doing that now. I would urge you, most of us aren't even conscious of what's going on, so I would urge you to inform yourselves, and I hope that in time the statistical profession will take a position on the forefront of advocating for data transparency and reforms in the clinical research process so that public trust in these issues, in these areas, can be restored. If we don't, and we become perceived as marketers, then I think it's to the grave, grave disadvantage of our profession in the future. And let me stop there and leave this up for you to look at. Thank you very much. And I apologize for leaving the handouts at home. Please email me if you are interested.
Much. Our next presenter, and by the way, we will have time for more questions at the end of the presentations. Our next presenter is Natalie Duncan from the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center in Indianapolis, Indiana, and she will be presenting on